This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the Collector Car Hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, air pollution, a product of a chemical soup that surrounds us. We'll give you the recipe and tell you what it does to you. Our Ear to the Ground Linda Anderson profiles watchdogs of a government agency which spends your money killing wild animals it calls pests. A listener question about garbage on the beach. Author Rick Bass has a portrait of the Yaak Valley in Montana. And in the Earth Calendar, join our chorus of frogs in southern Illinois and sing for a mate. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. The United States Environmental Protection Agency is proposing to revise the air regulations to reduce the amount of pollutants which produce the smog and soot in the air we breathe. The reason is to improve our health. Where do these pollutants come from, and what effect do they have on our bodies? A key component of smog is ozone. Professor John Seinfeld, chairman of the Division of Engineering and Applied Science at the California Institute of Technology, talks about how it's formed.
When we refer to smog, the chemical constituent that EPA focuses on is ozone. Ozone is a gas containing three oxygen atoms. It's found naturally in the atmosphere, and in the stratosphere, it's very important to life on Earth, but in urban atmospheres and over large regions of the country, ozone becomes elevated as a result of man's emissions. And these emissions are hydrocarbons and oxides of nitrogen, both of which come from combustion processes, from cars, from all kinds of sources, and when these hydrocarbons and oxides of nitrogen are emitted in high levels and are acted upon by sunlight, they generate ozone, and it's the ozone that the U.S. EPA focuses on for the past and the proposed revised air quality standard. And that's because ozone is the compound in the gas phase part of smog that's thought to be responsible for health effects.
And it therefore requires sunlight to form, is that correct?
That is correct.
Seinfeld says on cloudy days of diminished sunlight, less ozone is created. However, once it's produced in the chemical stew of our air, it's stable, and its impact can be far-reaching. Seinfeld says there's a blanket which covers the entire Northeast and a plume which on occasion stretches all the way to Europe. Spurring the efforts to reduce ground-level ozone is the effect it has on our health.
The health effects that have been measured fairly objectively for high-level ozone, that is, extreme smog conditions and moderate smog conditions, include symptoms such as chest tightness, on occasion in some susceptible people, wheeze. There has been a suspicion, and only a suspicion, that people were more prone to infectious diseases of the lungs, such as pneumonia. And for susceptible people, more visits to the emergency room.
That was Simon Spivak, assistant professor of medicine at the Albany Medical Center in New York. He conducts research on ozone-related lung disease in the laboratory. And he describes what ozone does to the lung itself.
Well, ozone is chemically about the most potent oxidant we know, which means it is the equivalent, I suppose, of rusting the human body, albeit quickly. That is, it causes a chemical change, or what is termed oxidation of various chemicals. And since the lung is a very broad surface area, it seems to be that organ most exposed and therefore most susceptible to these effects.
Paradoxically, while we want to reduce ground-level ozone, ozone in the stratosphere is essential to shield us from radiation from the sun. In addition to reducing ozone, the proposed new air regulations are designed to regulate and reduce soot by regulating particles as small as 2.5 microns rather than the 10-micron size in the current regulations. Seinfeld describes where the particles come from.
Particles come from two sources. Many particles are emitted directly from sources. We've all driven behind a bus and or a large truck and been caught in the plume of black particles coming out of the tailpipe. And so there are a number of places where particles get emitted directly into the air. But a very important part of particles, and maybe half of the particles by mass, actually come from chemistry that occurs in the air once the particles are up there that involve the gases. And the gases react and they produce certain products that like to stick to the particles.
The particles themselves, he says, are too small to be seen by the naked eye and can only be seen under a microscope. In considering what impact particles have on our health, Dr. Spivak says we know more about what they do than how they do it.
This is a case where the epidemiology, meaning the examination of populations, seems to lead the basic science. The truth is, across many studies and many rigorously performed epidemiologic studies, there are measurable health effects, including mortality and morbidity, or what is termed adverse health effects short of dying.
Spivak says researchers do not agree on whether the fine particle itself, which can cause scarring of the lung when inhaled, or the chemicals like sulfates, sulfur dioxide, and sulfuric acid, which the particle picks up in the atmosphere and carries into the lung, cause more damage. The thing he says is clear is that at times of high air pollution, one should stay inside and resist the temptation to go jogging. Considering ozone, he says because of its chemical properties, there will be less indoors than in the air right outside the window.
Ozone is so reactive, it reacts with virtually any surface with which it comes in contact with. In fact, if you work with it in the laboratory, you have to use steel, plexiglass, or Teflon. It eats away at virtually everything else. In that sense, it gets absorbed and reacts with surfaces before actually coming through ventilation systems and getting indoors.
Spivak says the current debate about the cost-effectiveness of tightening air pollution standards is a political one. But from a medical standpoint, air pollution today affects the health of a great many of us who have lung disease or are very young or very old.
Clearly, tens of millions of people fall in the categories of the extremes of age or those with pre-existing lung disease.
Dr. Simon Spivak is assistant professor of medicine at the Albany Medical Center. The Environment Show has a new email address. It's green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind or send us questions you have about the environment. Or you can visit us anytime on the Internet where you can hear The Environment Show. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. Again, our new email address is green@wamc.org, and our telephone is 1-888-49-GREEN. Producer Stephanie Goichman has this week's listener questions.
In response to our Talking Green on bottle bill requirements, we heard from a caller, Brad Weiss of St. Paul, Minnesota. He wondered how marine life and the environment were affected by beach debris, commenting that military and cruise line ships are dumping waste offshore and should be addressed as well. We turned to the Center for Marine Conservation in Washington, D.C., and spoke to project coordinator Siba Shively.
Each year, the Center for Marine Conservation coordinates a massive beach cleanup activity that takes place all over the world in over 90 countries. And our surveys show us that a large majority of the debris that we're finding along our coastlines and along our rivers and lakes is actually the result of of litter that's coming from recreational activity. About 60% of all that we find is actually coming in the form of cigarette butts and straws and plastic cups and bottles and cans and waste that is actually generated from normal recreational activity. A very small portion of it can be attributed actually to shipboard activity. It's illegal to dump shipboard waste. In our territorial waters here in the United States, we have a very, you know, very strict law enforcement of that, and that applies to our own ships in terms of the military and other ships that actually come to visit us. There are huge fines, and it's illegal, and the ship's captains and owners pay a very heavy price.
Thanks, Eba. If you have a question you'd like to ask us, give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN, and we'll do our best to find an answer. I'm Stephanie Goichman.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, Wildlife Damage Review, Protecting Predators by Controlling the Controllers. Outraged by what they saw as the government's widespread and unnecessary killing of wildlife on public and private lands, Wildlife Damage Review was formed in 1991 to scrutinize the United States Department of Agriculture's Animal Damage Control Program, or ADC. According to Wildlife Damage Review's Nancy Zernberg, the ADC was developed around the turn of the century to benefit agriculture and livestock industries by targeting perceived pest species. These, quote, pest species, she says, have included wolves, bears, mountain lions, fox, coyote, bobcat, and badger.
Our group felt like this has been an industry that's been very secretive within the livestock industry. The public generally has no clue there is such a program. They definitely don't know that they pay for it. And to the tune of $38 million this last fiscal year, and we felt that the public needed to be apprised of this and have pulled together to become a clearinghouse of information and do our best to get that information that we collect back out to the public.
Collecting information on the ADC has not been easy, Zernberg explains. They've had to rely heavily on the Freedom of Information Act. Wildlife Damage Review has been hounding the ADC for 6 years now, and Zernberg feels it's paying off.
ADC has been forced to be in the public spotlight. This last year, Congressman DeFazio from Oregon finally has made this a congressional issue. He introduced an amendment to the appropriations process for agriculture to cut ADC's funding to cut out the Western Livestock Program monies, and that amounted to about half of their operational funding. The measure failed. However, we discovered that there were 139 congresspeople who did vote to support that. So I think there are a lot of congressional champions out there who don't like a lot of aspects of the ADC program.
Aspects, explained Zernberg, like spending millions of taxpayer dollars to kill vast numbers of wild animals for private industry. The ADC accomplishes this by using methods she describes as indiscriminate and inhumane, such as leg hole traps, neck snares, poison, and aerial gunning. Zernberg says ADC policies is one thing, but evidence indicates that what they do in the field is another. So Wildlife Damage Review is making it their business to look over ADC's shoulder. The ADC, she explains, operates on the premise that predators are bad and domestic animals are good. This predator prejudice, she says, needs to stop. As far as protecting livestock, she continues, there are alternatives that preclude the killing of wildlife. Reform of ADC, she believes, is not possible.
We have to abolish the agency and base wildlife management on a premise that dismisses this idea of predator prejudice, because we do need all the parts to have a good functioning ecosystem.
With help from a growing network of groups and volunteers, Wildlife Damage Review feels they are on their way to making a difference. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they are city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Author Rick Bass makes his home in the Yaak Valley of northwestern Montana. A rich diversity of creatures grace the land to the delight of the few people who live there. But as with most places, the Yaak Valley is never far from danger. Never one to mince words, Bass deplores practices which spoil the land and eventually ruin people's ability to make a living. He reads from The Book of Yaak, published by Houghton Mifflin.
Yaak is the Kootenai word for arrow, and it is the name of the Montana Valley where I live. The Kootenai once hunted in the upper part of the valley, the place where my cabin is now. Those of us who live here now hunt through the ice for fish in January, hunt deer and elk in the snows of November, grouse in the blazing autumn. We gather berries in August and tend to our gardens in the brief summer. We hunt firewood, we hunt mushrooms. We hunt for the deer's dropped antlers. We hunt for fir boughs for Christmas wreaths. We hunt a duck or two. We hunt daisies and asters and lupine and paintbrush for our children in June. We hunt horses that have slipped through buck and rail fences knocked askew like toothpicks by night-passing moose. Three couples up here trap in tan hides. There are three preachers, two bars, a handful of hunting and fishing guides. We do seasonal work, rhythmic work, planting trees in the spring to try to regenerate the scabrous clear cuts. We saw roadside lodgepole blowdown for firewood and 100-inch studs to cart to Libby or Bonner's Ferry in the backs of our beat-up pickups. The people who live here, who stay here, have fallen in love with the shape of this land, its cycle of days. There had to be some point, some moment, some place where something in me reached saturation, where I could not anymore accept the sight and the knowledge of what the roads and clear cuts were doing to the ecology of the valley as well as to the economy of man. Undoubtedly, this feeling of pain, of saturation, came at some point after I had gone through a full cycle of the four seasons, perhaps after I'd gone through them a couple of times. I moved through the woods on hikes and hunts, open-minded. The Yaak mixes the wildest of the Pacific Northwest with the wildest of the Northern Rockies. It's home to a surviving handful of grizzlies, wolves, wolverines, bull trout, lynx, and occasional caribou. And at first, foolishly, a handful seemed like enough. Two wolves, five wolverines, 15 grizzlies, like some full-circle replay of Noah's Ark. There still seemed to be plenty of diversity in the forest types I saw, and the roadless cores on the National Forest, the sanctuaries, still seemed intact. That was just over a decade ago. I'm not sure when I began to realize that they, the timber industry, wanted it all, or if not all of it immediately, then access to all of it forever. Or, as the occasional bumper sticker declared, wilderness equals land of no use. I think that the point at which what was being done to the valley began to hurt me deeply was the time I first began to feel that I was starting to fit, that the landscape and I were engaged in a relationship, that I was being reshaped and refashioned to better fit it in spirit and desire, that I was neither fighting this nor resisting it. As it became my home, the wounds that were being inflicted upon it, the insults, became my own. No one can say for sure when a place becomes your home or when a fit is achieved or peace, any more than one can say when a river best fits the valley through which it cuts. It flows and changes, shifts, cuts deep in some places, fills in others. It transports sediment, logs, and lives. It makes music in the day and in the night. Animals come down out of the mountains at dusk to stand at the river's edge and drink. In the dimness, as light fails, the animals sometimes cross the river, swimming or wading. Even the valley itself is moving, shifting slightly, the mountains like the slowest yet most powerful pistons in the world, some rising and others falling. The valley sinking and tilting toward the ocean. And as it sinks, it carries within it, as if in a bowl or a nest, all the surprises, secrets, and cycles, all the miracles anyone could ever ask for. More miracles than even the most uncompromising glutton could desire. We are all born with an appreciation of, a love and a need for the beauty and grace of wilderness. But as if frightened of it, we carve, prod, and poke at the last roadless areas in the national forests. We view mystery as the enemy of knowledge and end up attacking mystery and in so doing we harm or alter the knowledge that lies beneath that mystery. We take in a manner that does not replenish. We search out the last corners to clear-cut and road-build into even these cores, as if we have become confused, as if forgetting that we cannot live, cannot survive, without grace and magic.
Rick Bass, reading from the Book of Yak, published by Houghton Mifflin. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. Spring has arrived early this year in southern Illinois. Ice is melting and wetlands are ringing with the sounds of frogs. These are Cope's tree frogs and eastern gray tree frogs. They're among a wide range of frogs just now emerging from their winter hibernation along the Cache River. Mark Getterslaw is a district heritage biologist for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. He says frogs get right down to the business of mating when they wake up. Males make all the racket to attract the comparatively quiet females.
Frogs are kind of unique in that they take advantage of an opportunity. This time of year, like I said, we have a little more rainfall than we'll have later in the year, so they're taking advantage of habitat to reproduce that's not available any other time of the year, or if it would be available, they may have to compete with other species that are more capable of using that habitat than they are. Calls are, every time a frog feels amorous, he'll call. That's the only reason they have a voice, I guess, when you think about it. If it wasn't for reproduction, they probably wouldn't call at all.
Frogs are important creatures. They eat a lot of insects and are themselves important prey for larger creatures like fish and birds. Over the past decade, scientists have noted worldwide decline in frogs and other amphibians. Habitat destruction is the culprit in many cases, but the thinning of the ozone layer, pesticides, and climate change may contribute as well. This frog, the Illinois chorus frog, is the most endangered frog along the Cache River. Getterslaw says frogs are needed to keep the ecosystem healthy.
Well, I guess they're about in the middle of the food chain, and I'd like to think they're important just for being part of the ecosystem. Researchers are finding that along with invertebrates that you find in a water column, that reptiles and amphibians are a very good yardstick of ecosystem health. And we've noticed a decline in reptile and amphibian populations in southern Illinois in the last 10 years, and we think that's because of some of the degradation of our aquatic resources. So they're a wonderful way to keep track of the health of the aquatic system.
Getterslaw says that when the conditions are right, there are many frog species all making calls at once, and the sound can drown out conversation. These are spring peepers, which for many signal the end of winter. Each year, frog lovers from all over come to the Cache River to walk late at night and savor the sounds of frog amour and try to do an annual frog survey.
Well, I tell you, it's pretty neat. Obviously, you start after dark. That's when most of these things start making noises, right at sunset and then on into the night. The forest is quite dense here in most of these places, but we do hear them in stop. We have stops near little ponds out in the middle of agricultural areas, so it's quite a diversity of sites that we find these, but generally, like the most common frogs, the peepers, the cricket frogs, bullfrogs, if you have a good, warm, humid night, a little bit overcast, the noise can actually be quite deafening, and it's even hard, it's actually very hard to pick up all of the species there and then make some kind of a guess as to the numbers present. It's a pretty unique experience. All the heritage biologists in Region 5 here in southern Illinois do this. Here at the Cache River, we have a set frog survey that we do for the whole basin, and it consists of three routes, and we get volunteers and staff people to go out about twice a month and listen and record not only the number of species that you hear, but try to make a course estimate of how many individuals we actually hear.
So if you're feeling a bit lonely and stir-crazy from the winter, take a walk down to your local wetland and join the party. You can peep or croak or even be a frog Pavarotti. Just begin calling and you may even score a date. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, life can be better if we stop cooking ourselves with big parking lots and hotspots in cities. We talk green about cars that don't burn gas. Author Joe Kane speaks with us about the Huarani people and their fight against oil drilling in their native Amazonia. And the folk duo Magpie sing out against rainforest destruction. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. As we heard earlier, heat plays a significant role in the creation of air pollution. It also can make a city in summer absolutely miserable. Scientists have learned that urban areas have become so-called heat islands, increasing energy usage and air pollution. Remedying the problem will take years, but the benefits are expected to be significant. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
If you've ever walked across a black asphalt parking lot on a hot summer's day, you already know about heat islands. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that it's cooler under trees in the forest than in the middle of a concrete jungle. But scientists are just learning how heat islands function and their costs. Joseph Rahm is a deputy secretary at the U.S. Department of Energy.
A heat island is pretty much any city or location which is hotter than the surrounding area because trees have been cut down and because roofs and pavements are darkened, which mean that they absorb the heat from the sun and re-radiate it, which is the case for most major cities in this country, are several degrees Fahrenheit warmer than they would otherwise be if they were better designed or than they originally had been.
For instance, in Los Angeles, temperatures in the summer routinely measure 5 degrees higher than the surrounding suburbs. Rahm says emissions from cars and buildings only account for about 1% of the heat island effect. The rest comes from the sun's heat, which is absorbed into dark surfaces. He says the cost to the environment is significant.
There are two major effects of heat islands. First of all, because the city is hotter, the air conditioning usage is greater than it would otherwise be. And since electricity demand peaks in the summertime, typically, this means much greater, 20% higher peak electricity consumption in the country as a result of these urban heat islands. The second effect of urban heat islands is the fact that smog, the generation of smog, is very temperature dependent. So you get smog when the hotter it is, the more smog you get above a certain temperature. So if we could cool the cities down, we would have less ozone smog.
Combating heat islands will take many years. Trees must be allowed time to grow, and dark surfaces like rooftops will likely be changed only after their present surface wears out. But in this case, change has very few side effects. Although light surfaces in summer is a plus, some may worry about losing positive effects of heat retention in winter. But scientists say this shouldn't be much of a worry, since the sun is significantly weaker during those months. Rahm says if we start now, the savings can be significant.
There is no question that if you are willing to take a 10-year approach, that is to say, when roads need to be repaved, you use lighter color material. When roofs need to be painted, you use lighter color paint, and you begin the process of planting trees, that for a very low cost, you can have a very large impact. In Los Angeles alone, we calculate for a very modest cost that you could reduce annual air conditioning bills by $150 million and that you could reduce smog concentrations by 10% and that in Los Angeles alone would be worth another $300 million a year. So we are talking about, in a city like Los Angeles, of nearly $500 million in savings, and for the country as a whole, over $10 billion in savings in the 2010 to 2015 timeframe if we began now being somewhat aggressive in our efforts to reduce urban heat islands, and I think the cost would be rather modest.
Most of the nation's fastest-growing cities are in the southern half of the country, and thus the need to avoid heat islands there is crucial. Those cities are also more car-dependent than older cities, which means falling out of compliance with air pollution standards fairly often is a real possibility. Alan Lloyd is the director of the Desert Research Institute in Nevada. He says addressing heat islands is cheap and effective.
These days, one has to look at the cost effectiveness of various control measures. And well, we've seen in the past some programs being very cost effective. As we look today, then we in fact look at programs which can be quite costly for relatively minor improvements. And yet this is what we're getting to because of the limited options available to us. This strategy has the potential to be quite cost effective. I hesitate to give a number, but I would say that they would be very commensurate with current strategies in terms of dollars per pound of precursors reduced, etc.
Besides the expected benefits of cost savings and benefits to air quality, heat islands also reduce the general quality of life in a community. Meanwhile, the solutions are relatively low cost and only add to quality of life. The Department of Energy has begun working with manufacturers and buildings to spread the word about heat islands. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Hi, I'm your host, Peter Burley, and you're listening to Talking Green and the Environment Show. Today, we're going to talk about alternative fuel vehicles, a subject that is receiving increasing interest, particularly as the nation tries to meet our clean air standards, and we always ask ourselves whether there are better alternatives than the gasoline engine. We have some distinguished guests, but first, our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. And we're joined by Ray Smith, who is from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in Oakland, California, Paul McCardle, who is an economist for the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Transportation, and Pat Mosley, who is with the International Lead Zinc Research Organization. Ray, let's start with you. I understand that you're at the World Car Conference. What do you see out there that is likely to make it to the marketplace and be a logical alternative fueled vehicle?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things that Chrysler has just announced, you've probably heard of, is the idea of using the current infrastructure for gasoline and bring on fuel cell vehicles by doing onboard reforming in order to generate the hydrogen required by the fuel cell. That has got everybody in a bit of a buzz. It bridges the problem of having the infrastructure for the alternative fuel.
Now, Pat Mosley, as I understand it, you're involved with the lead-acid battery development process. There are those that say that the lead-acid battery is a thing of the past and it's either going to be nickel hydride or a fuel cell or whatever. Is there really any future in the lead-acid battery as it relates to the automobile?
I think there's no doubt about that. The lead-acid battery has a large advantage in terms of cost, and its performance is improving even now. Although the history of the battery is well over 100 years, it was invented by a European in the last century, and some of the earliest four-wheeled vehicles that ran without the advantage of horses actually were electric vehicles, and they were displaced when internal combustion engine came along. But now we're seeing a resurgence of electric vehicles, and the electric vehicles we're seeing on the streets today are powered by lead acid.
And when you say that the federal government is buying a lot of these things, what kind of alternative fuel vehicles are they buying? Are they buying electric or natural gas?
Well, we bought some electric, although that has not been the majority up to this point. The major bulk of that 27,000 vehicles I mentioned to you are mainly compressed natural gas vehicles and also what's called flexible fuel vehicles that run on a combination of M85 or gasoline. M85 being a blend of 85% methanol, 15% gasoline. We have purchased smaller amounts of electric vehicles and also propane vehicles.
You know, it's interesting that we think of alternative fuels or vehicles that can burn different kinds of fuel as sort of a modern innovation. On my farm, I have a 1945 John Deere tractor that was built to start on gas and then switch to kerosene.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that was standard technology in those days because it was cheaper. And so there's been a history, I guess, of alternative.
Yes, absolutely. I think propane is a perfect example where people got very excited about alternative fuels really kind of in the 1980s when people were really concerned, started to get more concerned about energy security, the environmental issues.
And, yeah. then the gas became plentiful again, and we forgot it all. Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Jason Mark. Jason, you're on the air on Talking Green. I understand you're at the World Car Conference as we speak.
That's correct. We're down here in Riverside, California, where the air quality is worse than any other city in the entire nation. So it's an appropriate place to be talking about the new generation.
So let me ask you, did you drive to get there to go to the World Car Conference?
Well, we certainly took a plane down here and then a shuttle over to the hotel. Absolutely. The political realities today require you to sort of use the existing transportation network.
And what is your question or comment for the panel?
Well, I guess the Union of Concerned Scientists attempts to sort of step through these broad array of different challenges, and I think what's absolutely critical, and I think this is more of a comment than a question at first, is setting out some real public interest goals for evaluating different options. In other words, which technologies and fuels give us the best benefits in terms of air pollution reduction, in terms of avoiding the potential hazardous impacts of global warming, and to lower our impact on oil dependence. And I think
And where do you come out on that?
Well, I think when you look at that range of different issues, there is a small family of technologies and fuels that fall out, and those are a combination of vehicles that are extremely clean, that use an electric drive type of system, and number two, are able to use renewable fuels as their major source of energy.
Well, thanks for your call. Let me ask all of you something that I think has bothered listeners that we've heard from, both directly and over email. They say, listen, when it comes to electric vehicles, the fact is that the electricity is produced in a power plant. Aren't you simply substituting a stationary source for a mobile source without much gain? What's the answer to that?
Well, this is Pat Mosley. Perhaps I can make a first answer at that. Most of the electricity power in California, where the move to electric vehicles has come to the surface first, is generated by, well, a large amount of it is generated by power plants that don't produce the products that we're concerned about, the atmospheric pollution. And that's an important factor to bear in mind. The second one is that if you're balancing a power stationary power plant and its environmental impact with a vehicle, you're comparing, in the one case, a plant where you can actually deal with it on the spot in one place, with one in which you're distributing it very efficiently around the streets. And I think there's actually no comparison to be drawn between the two cases.
Let's go back to the phones, clear across the country to Arlington, Virginia. Jill, you're Talking Green on the Environment Show.
Hi, thank you for giving me the opportunity to ask a question. I'm interested in why we should be looking at alternative fuels. I know that I've heard some talk about externalities, and I wondered if Mr. McCardo could just expand on why, or the other panelists, why we should be looking at alternative fuels when gasoline is so cheap.
Okay, and externalities, I'm sure, is a concept that is going to glaze our listeners' eyes over entirely. So
let me take a
for those that are still awake, what's the answer?
I'll take a shot at that, Peter, and talk about two specific externalities, and that'd be the energy imports and also the environmental externalities. First, the energy imports. We're importing larger and larger portions of our transportation fuel mix from imported sources, and that number, with given projections, looks like it's going to go higher. So we have to expend significant funds in terms of protecting our access to those energy sources, which in itself is an externality. There's a lot of debate on how much that externality is worth. Number two, on the environment, obviously, all these transportation devices, at least most of them, emit pollutants that go up into the air. They're not priced in the marketplace. So that's a non-market externality being emitted there that's not encompassed in the price of the transportation mode. So those are the, I think, two externalities that everybody's trying to address on this issue, and how to meet those address those externalities in the lowest possible cost.
And just so that we haven't lost everybody, when externalities, you're talking about forces that are beyond simply the price that the consumer pays.
Right. They're not embodied in the market price of the commodity or service, depending on what you're referring to.
Let me,
Peter,
yes.
May I put something in perspective there? I think the general consumer indeed looks at the price of gasoline as being very low, and indeed in real dollars it is.
Indeed, isn't it as low as practically at
since World War II?
Since World War II levels,
it's just about a historic low. A few years ago, it was certainly at that point. But put it another way, the U.S. spends $1 billion a week for imported oil. Now, what could we do with that money if we spent it within this country?
Okay, Pat, in 20 seconds, would you stick with a strong absolute requirement that there be a certain number of emission-free vehicles sold?
Yes, I think we do need to have that continued incentive, but I think it needs to be supplemented by a program of education and infrastructure development. Whichever of these alternative fuels we are involved with requires an acceptance and adoption of a totally new technology or a radically new technology over what people are familiar with.
Great. Well, I want to thank you. I'm afraid our time is up. I've been joined by Ray Smith, who is from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, Paul McArdle from the Department of Energy's Office of Transportation, and Pat Mosley from the International Lead Zinc Research Fund Organization. Thank you all. You're Talking Green on the Environment Show. I'm your host, Peter Burley, and our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. In the Amazon jungle, many indigenous people are fighting against pollution created by foreign companies. Joe Kane, author of the book Savages, details the plight of the Huarani people. They consider themselves the fiercest people on Earth, defending a part of the jungle that is the size of Massachusetts. But when they ran up against mostly American oil companies, they found themselves outgunned and their homeland polluted. The Huarani live in the Oriente region, which have more species than anywhere else on Earth. 5 to 10% of all species on the planet live there. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally spoke with Joe Kane about his experiences with the Huarani.
85% of the Oriente has been auctioned off to oil companies. The people who live there have what are called subsurface rights. That means they have no right to the oil underneath their land. Even if it's their land and they own it and they have title to it, they not only have a right to the oil, have no right to the oil, they have no right to the royalties from that oil, and they have no right to say no to oil development. So even though some of that land is privately held, still it has been auctioned off to oil companies. Mainly American companies. Texaco produced the first commercial oil from the Oriente in 1972, and it was the major company in there from 1972 till 1992 in partnership with the Ecuadorian National Company. Since then, Occidental is in there, Mobil, Oryx, Maxis, Arco, and a dozen or more smaller companies as well. Texaco built a 312-mile pipeline from the heart of the Oriente over the Andes out to the Pacific coast. From 1972 to 1992, the pipeline ruptured at least 27 times and spilled at least 17 million gallons of raw petroleum directly into the forest. That's 1.5 times as much oil as the Exxon Valdez spilled off the coast of Alaska. But that was only a fraction of the damage the company did, and none of that was cleaned up, by the way.
So bring us along in the story with the Huaranis and tell us what happened to them where they are now.
Well, they took me into their territory and took me, initially on a horrendous trek across, one of the richest areas in terms of biological diversity on the planet, which means dense, dense forest. And the Huarani territory in particular is rich because they've been able to keep people out for so long. And we hiked. I was in there for about 6 weeks on that first trip. Didn't know the Warani at all, didn't know what to expect. It's all, I laid it out in Savages in the book in detail, but to sum it up, I just about died in there. Almost died of starvation. I didn't know that a Warani, for example, can go for 10 days without eating if he's out hunting, but then we'll sit down and eat up to 8 pounds of meat, usually monkey, at a single sitting. I didn't know how to, I wasn't adapted to that. We got lost in the forest. We got beyond the Warani hunting territory. It didn't bother the Warani terribly because they just kept going, but I went into kind of a hypothermia and nearly died. It was brutal. I couldn't speak the language. I could speak Spanish, and there were one or two young Warani who I traveled with who spoke some Spanish. Other than that, I couldn't speak the language at all. I didn't know that I was supposed to give away whatever I had. The Warani ideal is to be so self-sufficient, so in tune with the forest, if you will, that you have no fear of need because you know you can go out in the forest and get whatever you need. So you give away whatever you have, and especially you give away your food. And so they simply looted me of everything I had. I traveled with a number of young men in there, in Kiri and Amo and Nanto and Moy, and I write about them in detail in the book. Very brave and very brave young men trying to, and when I say young, they're between 25 and 30 years old. They were trying to bridge this gap, really, from Stone Age to Petroleum Age. Not only did they have to live like Warani, providing for their families and such, but they had to live like cannibals, coyotes as well. They had to be able to speak in a way that Westerners could understand. They had to speak two languages. They had to crisscross their territory, which, again, was enormous, without benefit of anything but their canoes and their feet, to try to organize these small and roving clans into a nation that could speak with one voice. They had to fight American evangelical missionaries who have controlled large parts of the territory for 30 or 40 years now and who treat the Warani as, well, as they say, as demons and savages, and who think that any attempt by the Warani to organize themselves into a federation is an act of communists. And the evangelical missionaries who have enormous power, and virtually all, by contract, they're in charge of the health, education, and welfare of the Warani, which makes them really the rulers of the Warani territory on paper. They have fought the Warani Federation's tooth and nail since the Warani first began trying to organize. So, a daunting task for these young men. And really, for me, for writing the book, for writing Savages and reporting for The New Yorker, mainly I relied on my travels with them, both in the territory and later when they began to come into Quito. They would stay at my apartment, Quito being the capital city of Ecuador, a very modern city. They would come to the apartment with their spears and their headbands, and they'd be waiting for me when I got home, and they'd out on the front of the building and scaring the bejesus out of the passersby just by their mere presence. The Warani are very strong-looking people, and they can be quite stoic. They're in private when you're with them, and they're relaxed. They're enormously funny. They're great mimics and storytellers, but they know how to put on a good public face. And walking through Quito would be like walking through Boston or San Francisco, with their heavily muscled arms, accentuated with armbands, and their faces tattooed, and their big, long Warani spears, which everyone in Ecuador knows are man-killing spears. They could be quite a sight. And then we'd go take off on hunting treks, down to the local grocery store, the local Safeway. We'd go hunting for frozen chicken, because that was the cannibal food they knew well, was chicken and rice, and then come back to the apartment, and usually they never traveled alone, so I'd have 12 or 15 Warani staying in my apartment. And, of course, they would help themselves to whatever I had, because that's the way you did it. So they took all my, jackets and shirts, and they always wanted waterproof stuff. They learned about that very quickly. Things like, one of the first cannibal words they learned well was Gore-Tex. They knew that would keep them very dry in the forest, and would also dry out itself very quickly. So I really traveled in, it was really an adventure in two worlds, both me in the Warani territory and the Warani in my country.
So are you generally hopeful for the Warani?
The Warani will survive. Whether they'll survive as Warani is the question. If they're simply culturally destroyed, they'll be nothing more than slaves. They'll occupy the lowest rung of a catastrophically poor society. But I think there will always be Warani who survive as Warani with a sense of themselves. They will change, and even the Warani will tell you they want to change. There's certain things they can use. They like rubber boots, for example, because it helps prevent snake bite. They want to learn Spanish. They want to be able to write.
Environment Show producer Thomas Lally speaking with Joe Kane, author of the book Savages. The experiences of the Warani people are not unique. Rainforests around the world are being destroyed for timber, oil, minerals, and grazing land. While there are some success stories where parcels of land have been preserved, rainforests and the indigenous people who live in them are imperiled. Greg Artstern and Terry Leonino make up the folk duo Magpie. We hear the rainforest song from their release entitled Living Planet.
Well, I took a little trip down to Brazil of the rainforest beauty to get my fill. But what I saw made my heart so sad, for what the people were doing was oh so bad. They were flooding the valleys, making a jam for a big hydroelectric dam, killing all the trees and the animals there, taking out the green things that make our air. I looked up through the sky, and there I saw the beating wings of a great red macaw. And I said, fly away up in the sky. Around this world you're bound to roam. Fly above the treetops so high. Fly until you find your home. Well, I followed that bird where it did go, and it took me all the way down to Borneo. There we found just more of the same, only this time it was the logging game. Greedy people were up to no good, making their fortunes on exotic wood. They don't care what might be in their way, while there are animals and people dying every day. My feathered friend said this just ain't right, but a poor macaw cannot stay and fight. He had to fly away up in the sky. Around this world you're bound to roam.
Greg Artstner and Terry Leonino, the folk duo called Magpie, singing the rainforest song from their CD entitled Living Planet. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 375. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Caplet Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.